Hello and welcome to Future Proofing, the BBC Radio 4 series that explores ideas which will shape the future. The nature of crime is changing rapidly as technology offers both a nightmare vision of pervasive online offending and the prospect of powerful tools to fight against it. But what will we really need to guard against? And do the answers to questions about how to tackle future crime all reside in technology? Or does changing our view of the criminals offer a better hope?
I'd be interested to see how we think about crime in the future. Do we think about it as, well, this person was just born this way, they have a natural inclination to criminal behaviour, and therefore we should either just accept that they're bad and lock them up, or offer them some kind of therapy or drugs or genetic modification? I don't know, what would you do if someone was innately bad? Or are we going to think it's this crimogenic environment that they're in, and therefore we will do that? Or will we think of the whole thing in a kind of big data way and say we can actually put everybody into a computer and we can predict who is going to commit the crime, and we'll send a drone to follow them round and we'll let them know that we're watching them, and then they won't?
My fear about this programme is I don't want to look into the face of future crime. I don't want to see what it might be, because I don't want my present to be contaminated by it. I don't want to be afraid. I don't want to think, who is hacking my personal data? Who is stealing my personal identity right now? Who's cloned my DNA? The thing I least want to discover is just how surveyed we already are and are going to be. The thing I least want to sense is that our own autonomy, our own capability to make decisions, to be good people on our own, not out of fear, is going to slip through our hands.
Welcome to Future Proofing. I'm Timandra Harkness.
And I'm Leo Johnson. What is the future of crime? Is it unimaginably scary? Is it an omni-hackable, omni-shambles of law enforcement?
Or is it just going to be a low-level, pervasive nuisance? Are we headed for surveillance so intensive it's going to make the Stasi look like Dixon of Dock Green?
Or is it paradise we're headed for? The post-crime future where surveillance has eradicated crime completely?
Or where nobody wants to commit a crime because we all love each other and we're happy?
That's enough of that. This is hard talk here. So what is Crime and Punishment 2.0?
I hope we haven't got you out of bed too early.
Oh, no, I'm fine. Thank you.
But the law never sleeps, right?
That's true. My name is Mark Goodman. I am the author of the book Future Crimes. In terms of background, I spent a career in law enforcement, worked as a police officer, detective. Most good crooks have gone onto the internet, where you can rob literally 100 million people at a time. We've seen numerous breaches where over 100 million accounts were compromised. One single criminal was able to rob simultaneously 100 million people.
Doesn't that mean that they could rob 100 million people, but for each of those people, the robbery is not catastrophic? So if we think of crime like a disease, then instead of crime being something like cholera, which will just wipe you out, it becomes something like a cold, where it's annoying, but you just live with it because it's not going to make that much difference to any individual.
They're not limited to having just more victims. They can take out more victims at higher price points. And this is why a lot of criminals are moving away from end individual users to small and medium business all the way up to the largest corporations. The challenge for us as a society is that every physical object in our space is being transformed into an information technology, which means that it can be hacked, that people can use these tools against us. And as the price of computing drops, we will have billions of new devices connected to the internet. So tools that you bring into your home to protect yourself and your family, such as a digital alarm or to save energy with a smart thermostat such as the Nest, can be hacked. parents who get baby cameras to protect their children by putting a camera in their child's room are also bringing in the opportunity for a predator to reach out and touch their children across the globe.
So yeah, there's already a search engine out there for people to search for images of sleeping children, isn't there?
Sleeping children, breastfeeding mothers, doctors' offices. Up until now, cybercrime has been limited to our computer screens. You lose some money from your bank account or somebody steals your identity, but broadly, nobody gets hurt physically. That's going to change increasingly as computers come into our physical space. If somebody hacks your credit card, nobody dies. But if somebody hacks the brakes on your car at 100 kilometers an hour, right, that could result in death. If somebody hacks a pacemaker, a hospital, an air traffic control system, an aeroplane, and by the way, each one of those hacks has actually taken place, then there could be ensuing death.
So what can law enforcement do to take control of some of this technology and use it? Or is that the wrong way? Will it need a whole different approach?
The internet fundamentally broke policing. And what I mean by that is that all policing is done at the local or national level. And yet criminals have the opportunity to jump from country to country, server to server, constantly shifting their IP addresses in a matter of minutes. So then we need a new paradigm. And I think that paradigm is one of epidemiology. If you wanted to get to the root cause, like from a true epidemiological perspective, we would have much better coding. We would incentivize both in the marketplace and potentially regulation the importance of secure coding. I didn't bring a gun into the UK. What I brought was a 3D printer and printed a gun in the UK. So the 3D printer, again, breaks the security paradigm, which has stood for centuries. We'll also see criminals using 3D printers, so-called chem printers, to produce new forms of narcotics.
And what about the most personal form of information then? What if someone could hack my genome?
Our genetic information will tell untold secrets about us. Some of the things that I can do with that is A, extort you, because I know that you have a particular disease or proclivity that you wouldn't want, but I can actually create bespoke bioweapons, something that wouldn't affect 99 out of 100 people, but given a particular genetic defect that you have, would be poisonous or lethal to you. I can also take your genetic material and use it without your consent, basically put it on a Xerox photocopier genetic equivalent and produce it en masse and put that genetic material at a crime scene and frame somebody else for a crime that they didn't commit.
So, Leo, what has that done for your levels of fear?
My big fear is the fear of fear. I would rather live in a state of blissful ignorance about to be smacked on the back of the head than live my life in a state of pre-victimhood waiting for a crime that's never going to happen.
Too late. He's told you everything that could possibly happen now.
I have faith. I'm off to Maidstone in Kent, because it's there that the police are upping their game and using exactly these same advances in technology to combat the perpetrators of evil.
We had a lot of police officers saying, well, this is going to tell me what to do. I know what to do. I'm a police officer. I've been a police officer for 10 years. Well, no, it's not doing that at all. It's just saying it's there, it's there.
That's where the ball's going to land.
Go and deal with it. You know,
skate to the puck.
Yeah,
that's where
exactly
the action's going to be.
Exactly that.
Can we take a look?
Yeah, of course. I need to log on. My name's Mark Johnson. I'm head of analysis at Kent Police. Predpol spots patterns that it identifies as a risk. So that is saying to us that there's likely to be a crime such as a burglary, and it's going to happen here. So what we did with Predpol was feed it with 5 years' worth of our crime data. Every single crime, when it happened, where it happened, what happened. It can do that in a way that we just don't have the cognitive ability to do. We don't. We just can't remember all that stuff. So it will basically highlight areas that are about half the size of a football pitch. They're relatively small. And they say, right, this is the area where it's likely to happen.
You can zoom us in. Wheel Street.
Yeah,
so the corner of Wheel Street and Brewer Street.
You
clicked on the box. And then we got the crimes in the last 180 days. We've got seven ASBs. What's ASB?
Antisocial behaviour.
Three violent crime, two criminal damage, two vehicles.
Yeah. There are some social issues there. There's poverty. We know as well that we've got some drug dealing going on down there as well. It does predict the low-hanging fruit, but it also predicts that fruit that we keep missing because there's just too much to do. So it's all this based on around the study of human groups, why people behave the way they behave, and why they take risks in the way that they take risks. And then it's applied to criminals, because criminals are just people like anyone else. Two officers go to a predpol zone and think, to be fair, what are we doing here? They come across a woman in distress with a child who's in a lot of distress. And the child's been assaulted, and been assaulted sexually. And the woman's also been violently assaulted. So they immediately take action. They find the offender. They find the man that's done this, and they arrest him immediately. And it turns out that this man is a particularly nasty individual wanted by the Metropolitan Police Service, yeah, for a number of similar offences. So in an area where they wouldn't have gone, and they were a little bit sceptical of it, you know, they were like, oh, come on, Sarge.
What had Predpol predicted? So, yeah, OK, so the boxer got highlighted.
Yeah.
But was that random? Was that a stroke of luck? Or had it identified that there was a potentially violent person there?
It had predicted that that zone was a high-risk area.
No, hold on. Had it identified that there was a guy who was about to beat up his wife and child?
Well, he was there.
That's not my question. Had it figured out that there was an individual who had a disposition?
No.
Who had a history, who moved in, with a backstory of having done this stuff before?
No, and I'll tell you what.
What was it that just didn't make that completely a random chance discovery?
Because it was a high-risk zone. It was a zone where you're more likely to find this kind of thing happening.
What does Predpol 10, 15 years down the track, what could it be doing?
It would give them information about areas of most harm, their ideal patrol strategy.
Let's go to that picture of those three girls.
Yeah.
You'd be able to get background on them. There'd be facial ID.
These photographs would be actually, you know, if
real
possible,
time.
Real time. Obviously, you know, there's surveillance, you know, there's...
Yep.
We don't want the government spying on us all the time, but...
Live data.
Yeah.
That would have analysed their Twitter feed, their Instagram accounts.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you've put a red box around a whole area, haven't you just designated that whole box as potentially criminal?
We've designated that area as an area where there may be crime committed. We're not saying that the people that live there are criminals. You know what? What we probably say is the people who are living there are pretty vulnerable.
Aren't you, in fact, making them more vulnerable? I'm thinking of the redlining in the US, where there were certain areas where a red line, just like your red line here.
Yeah.
And what that meant was the banks wouldn't lend.
Yeah.
No one could get a mortgage.
Yeah.
No one could get insurance.
Yeah, yeah.
People were scared to live there.
Yeah.
People put bars up on their windows. People moved out. And people developed quite an oppositional relationship with the police. Is there a risk this all takes us down that way?
There is a risk that does, yeah, you're absolutely right. We're not here to criminalise people that don't, you know, we're not, actually what we want to do is quite the opposite. You know, we want to keep people out of the criminal justice system. A lot of this is about preventing. We've seen around about a 7% reduction in what we call predpol crimes, so that's violence, antisocial behaviour, criminal damage, burglary, car crime and sexual crimes. Where we're getting the best out of it, we're seeing antisocial behaviour sort of disappear from some of the zones.
And how does it compare with, in terms of crime prediction, how does it compare with Copper's Nose?
Copper's Nose is right about 1 in 6. This thing was about 60% more accurate. This came out with about an 8.5%. The analysts were about 5.6. Randomly, it was 1. Doesn't sound like a lot, but if you think of all the hundreds of thousands of boxes in Kent, that's pretty significant.
What really worries me about Predpol is it's handing decision-making power not to the police, but to the algorithm. And the one thing the algorithm doesn't do is take flexible, context-based decisions.
The flip side is that there may be threats for which, actually, we would quite like the police to be equipped to use all the technology that they have, because the threat of terrorist attack, for example. So there's a British researcher called Jamie Bartlett, who wrote really well about this. He said, well, the problem at the moment is we have the illusion that the police know everything. We expect them to know everything and stop everything, which clearly they can't. And yet we also don't really trust them. So we've got the worst of both worlds.
The issue for me is the perception of surveillance. Think of Adam in the Garden of Eden. If he knew that a certain device, call it his iPhone 6, was monitoring what went on in the garden, would he have bitten that apple? If we enter into this world of perfect surveillance, into a route where something that's intrinsic to our humanity, our desire to fight for our freedoms, that gets snuffed out.
I think you're right. I think there's a very chilling effect if you think you're being watched and listened to all the time, that even minor expressions of dissent become something that you're self-conscious about and that might be a bit risky. So you go, oh, I'm not going to tweet that joke because the police might come around my house and arrest me for it. So even small expressions of, I wouldn't even call them dissent, but nonconformism become something that you have to think twice about. Maybe if the police don't have all the answers, we need to look for solutions in a better understanding of the criminals.
So for example, a dice game, Lucky Dice is called, and you can shake the device, but just tap it.
You shake your smartphone and you're shaking the
dice. And you get some dice, yeah, and it says how much you want, basically, based on how you shook it.
So by 2050, will there be any actual dice anywhere, or will all gambling just be online or on your smartphone?
I would look to the answer of how we read books nowadays, so...
Of all the industries moving online, gambling is one of the biggest. I'm here at ICE in London, one of the biggest international gaming conferences, and it's all about giving us the technology so we can gamble wherever and whenever the urge takes us, in our bedroom, on our smartphones. But with all this money moving online, it's also an expanding target for criminals.
My name is Madalin Dumitru. I'm the CEO and founder of Cyber Smart Defense, which is a company formed out of ethical hackers converted from real hackers into ethical hackers. Basically, this is the main asset we have in our company. Basically, we take care about the cybersecurity of companies by giving them real information from the underground world, from the cybercrime world.
I love this idea. You take real hackers and you transform them into ethical hackers.
You have to know your enemy, in my opinion. So if you know how he is thinking, at least you know how to what countermeasures you can take. We attack our customers. We conduct real scenarios, attacks towards their infrastructure in order to reveal all the vulnerabilities and fix them. Romania is well known for cybercrime, but the good news is that we are from Romania and we get the information from the inside. I am from Râmnicu Vâlcea, which is well known as Hackerville.
Hackerville, Transylvania?
Yeah.
What's it like?
It's a very nice small city on a mountainside with fresh air and good internet connection. It's quite easy to become a cyber criminal these days. Basically, when you go to rob a bank, you are more aware of the risks that you are exposing to. So when you are at home, you feel more comfortable and you believe that nobody can catch you. You can become a hacker if you want. It takes you 3 days, but not a hacker, a scammer. You can just place a fake auction on the eBay, selling a BMW worth of 40,000 euros for 12,000 euros. I believe you will have 80 inquiries, and if you ask 5 people to send you an advance payment to secure the transaction, or even some of them, they were asking money to put the petrol in order to deliver the car. So this is not hacking. What we are doing is really hacking. The real hackers are the ones that they penetrate, maintain access, and erase logs so they are not catched, and they stay there like silent killers for a long period, exploiting that infrastructure. So this is real hacking. You need a human touch. You need the human intelligence experience to analyze and even conduct manual penetration tests in order to be secure. This combined with a criminal mindset, in our opinion, is the best result you can have. And by the way, they are shareholders in the company, because people are asking us how we keep them. Basically, it's their company.
So maybe you can turn around your hometown, and instead of being Hackerville, it'll become White Hat Hackerville, because they'll all just become shareholders in your company.
You have a very good mindset. I would make you an offer, because we think the same from this perspective. Some of the hackers told me that it took 1.5 years in order to succeed their attack. So what they will do a social engineering information gathering from the open source, which is Google, LinkedIn, Facebook, all the social media websites, and so on. They will try to attack your private email. They will even come to your neighborhood and scan your wireless router in order to get access to your wireless router, because inside the company, everything is more protected than your home. But you connect from your home, to do some work in the company's office. So there is a vulnerability at the target's home. They will combine this with having access to surveillance cameras so you know your behavior. It's so easy to cheat on victims. We made an experiment in a hotel. We opened our laptop. This is, of course, for demo purposes. And we became an access point. We had, in 35 minutes, we had more than 80 devices connected to our access point. Of course, we were giving them internet. But in the meantime, we were seeing what they were doing, their username, passwords, chats.
What motivates criminal hackers? Is it just about the money?
No, it's not just the money. It's self-esteem, recognition from the community.
What's the thing that people should most be thinking about solving in the future?
Well, there is no privacy anymore. In the internet never forgets. Once you place the picture on the Facebook, whatever, on the social media, even if you have deleted that picture, it will actually not be deleted. Internet does not forget.
So that's all great then. We can sleep at night because somewhere on a Romanian mountainside with fresh air and great Wi-Fi, there's this sort of club med for cyber criminals, and they're all quietly going to hack us into a state of total security.
Well, I think the key message I took away was that although we think of it as a technological problem, actually it's all about the people. So yeah, we've got the white hat hackers who have the inside knowledge. But it did seem that the weakest point actually was the people, that the weakest point of anyone trying to hack into our stuff, Leo, would be you or me, because we're the ones that use the same password for everything and hook up to the free Wi-Fi wherever we go and generally leave our digital door wide open for people to come in.
I am so the weakest spot, and I'm, yes. But look, if we can be smart about the prevention, way, way smarter, isn't it time we turn to the other end of the spectrum and think not about smart prevention, but smart punishment of crime?
My name's Rebecca Roach. I'm lecturer in philosophy at Royal Holloway, University of London.
But what does smart punishment look like? What's the future of punishment?
If you could somehow know more about people's psychology, work out what their particular phobias were, how they like to live, how they don't like to live, and you could perhaps tailor their punishments to ensure that they have exactly the right amount of suffering.
What would it be for you?
I don't know, a prison cell full of spiders? That's not very technological.
So you could imagine, could this not be some virtual reality rig that you put on and gives you a 3D immersion in those spiders?
Right, yes. I mean, it could be.
How do you feel about that?
Not very happy, but...
Now, is that torture?
We'd have to think hard about whether it is. You know, is it important that people suffer in certain specific ways for certain crimes, or that people who've committed the same crime suffer exactly the same amount? And in that case, sort of technology could come in useful with enabling us to tailor the amount of suffering to the crime. The brain is basically an organ that sort of knocks around electronic information, essentially. And given that, it would be possible, if you had a powerful enough computer, to transfer that electronic information to a computer so that you had essentially uploaded somebody's mind onto a computer. And if you've done that and you have a sufficiently powerful computer, you then have the option to run it faster or slower. If you were to speed it up a sufficient amount, from the point of view of the person whose mind you've uploaded, they would experience, say, an hour passing in just a second of real time. Instead of sending people to real-life prisons, you could transfer their minds to sort of digital medium and just speed them up so that they serve a life sentence in half an hour.
Could technology, rather than, you know, amping up the fear, could it amp up the empathy and the remorse for the victims of the crime you've committed?
Increasing empathy might be something that we could do to rehabilitate psychopaths, because empathy is a capacity that psychopaths lack. So improving empathy might be a way of rehabilitating certain violent criminals, or, which would be better, if we could identify them before they committed crimes, morally enhancing them before they actually go on to do anything wrong.
It seems to be that the new idea of punishment would be very, very subjective. So rather than the idea being that everyone is equal before the law and you get the same length sentence in the same size prison
cell... It's bespoke. It's super bespoke punishment. It's, you know, it's Oculus Rift, virtual waterboarding. And the worst of all, the most horrific, that you would have virtual reality empathy, where you'd be able to see and experience the pain you've inflicted on others, begging for the death sentence as a reprieve.
The idea of deliberately tailoring a punishment to be worse, just why does it feel much crueler?
It feels inhumane.
And yet, when you say it's about making you feel empathy with your victim and therefore remorse, in a way that feels like, well, that should be what punishment is about, because that's the kind of rehabilitation that you go through, a rebirth, you feel empathy, you feel regret, you feel remorse, and then you're able to move on. Does feel like what it should be about, because it's about your human journey, isn't it?
It all gets to the makeup of the psyche. And flipping that knowledge, that insight into the psyche, instead of using it to torture the individual, using it, I think, to understand what are their motivations, what is driving them to crime.
I'm Dr. Maria Ioannou, and I'm a forensic psychologist at the University of Huddersfield. In order to understand the actions of many criminals, it is useful to consider the self-created narratives that help to give shape and significance to the actions of criminals. I was actually surprised that psychologists didn't go out to ask an offender what was their experience of the offence. I was very surprised that most of the crimes, I think it was about 70% of the crimes, could easily fit in one of four narratives.
But what you're saying is that the 70% of crimes where the individual is locked into a psychological state which could have been predicted, and where the crime delivers a certain payoff.
For the specific sample we examined, yes. These narratives motivate and sustain criminality. Four themes have been identified. The elated hero, the calm professional, the distressed revenger, and the depressed victim. The elated hero. This is a theme that describes an offender who perceives their criminal behavior to be an interesting, an enjoyable, and fascinating adventure.
So this is the elated hero, yes. And he just enjoys doing it.
Yes. For him, the crime is an enjoyable, it's a positive experience.
And what type of crimes does the elated hero enjoy doing?
It's mainly property offenders. In our sample, it was shoplifters, thieves, and burglars. The calm professional is an offender who sees his crime is perceived as a job. He is one who is acknowledging his criminal behavior, but he is one who engages in a criminal activity in a qualified, specialized, and confident manner.
So this is a sort of demonstration of expertise,
yes.
Of mastery.
Yes. And both the elated hero and the calm professional are positive and pleasant experiences from an offender. Now, the distressed revenger is a type of offender who feels that he has been wronged. And both violent offenders and for murderers, this was a predominant theme. The fourth theme that was identified is that of the depressed victim. So here we have an offender who sees himself as a victim of the situation. He does not regard himself responsible for his crime.
Are we all locked into a narrative?
Yes, we are.
How can you use this in solving crime?
Interviewing techniques can be tailored to individual cases. So, for example, a line of questioning that may be productive with a rapist, for example, who sees himself as a victim, we assume that would not work with a thief who sees himself as a hero.
Life is a Greek tragedy. Yeah, where we have no choice but to drive down the path that our narrative is driving us. Do you come to understand them and identify with them?
It depends on the case as well. I remember interviewing one offender. In the middle of the night, his brother knocked at his door and he said that I killed my wife. So can you please help me to dispose of the body? So we're talking about a very intellectual guy, an intelligent guy who hasn't done anything in his life. But he felt that he had to help his brother. He didn't have any other choice. They even cut the body into pieces. So they buried it in different places. And eventually they were caught. And he was, I think the sentence was 8 years. It was a tragic story. and you couldn't not but identify with that individual.
And in your category, where would he fit?
A depressed victim. He was someone who thought that what was happening was out of his control. He felt confused. He felt lonely. But that was the only choice. He couldn't just not do it.
So in terms of preventing crime, is the strategy for all of us to deliver the alternative rewards to people?
Yes. Rewriting or reauthoring that narrative and directing someone towards alternative ways of thinking about themselves, of thinking about crime, of thinking about more productive ways or good life narratives instead of these destructive narratives.
Fascinating, the idea that the crime is delivering a psychological payoff. And if you can deliver that psychological payoff by another means and slowly start to wean someone out of the necessity of putting themselves into the position of doing the crime to get it instead, that's good cure 70% of crimes.
So perhaps if we want to predict and prevent crime, instead of looking at the predpol boxes where the algorithm has said, here's a high-risk area, it's actually the boxes that we put ourselves into that we actually need to look at each individual person and what's the story they're writing of their own lives.
I was fascinated with the story of the guy who helped chopped up the body that his brother had just delivered to him.
That's pure Antigone, isn't it? It's my brother has asked me and therefore I must help him, even though I know it's wrong and a tragedy.
But the self-reinforcing nature of these boxes, like the walls get higher, because you see yourself as the depressed victim, you carry out acts that make you a really depressed victim.
And why would you get out of it unless someone says to you, this is just destructive, you need to find another way to get the things that you need.
So you need the psychic methadone. You know, you need the thing that gives you the hit through another non-violent, non-criminal mechanism. Gardening, spoon carving, or whatever it's going to be if you're a calm professional. Something where you've got agency, mastery, you can demonstrate control, I would imagine.
My name is Junior Smart. I'm founder of SOS Project. We're working with young people caught up in complex, chaotic backgrounds, and we're using trained ex-offenders to help them break that negative cycle. We're in like a pupil referral unit for the most hardest to reach, or the most disruptive students, and it's kind of sad to think that actually like the mainstream schools have like shunned them out. So this is a kind of a place that they get given a second chance.
If you knew anything about me or anything about my history, like, you'd be well shocked. The reality is, like, I set up SOS Gangs Project when I was in custody back in 2001. I was sent down for 12 years. Today, like, I want to talk to you guys about knife crime, gun crime, gang crime.
I was really sort of mortified and taken back by seeing the same young people come back into prison again and again. When I was very young, I believed that life was fair. I believed that actually if you work hard, you can get what you want. But I was robbed at a young age by a group of guys, and that kind of made me think, well, actually, it's not necessarily about doing the right thing. I was the kid at school that was always bullied. Imagine when I started creating fear in people, that actually it was okay. It wasn't against the law. Like, you know, the police didn't show up magically. It's not like television shows. Yeah, and actually you get that respect, you get that honour, and people are looking up to you. And I was like, well, hang on a second. Why did I go through school being the outcast, being the victim, when actually when I do this, which feels like the wrong thing, I get everything that I wanted in the start? What about this one? I know someone who's been stabbed. Raise your hands if this is true for you. Again, we're using fearless rules. I don't want to hear the name, just like who they were to you and where they got stabbed.
It was my friend. It was also a gang problem. He got sliced in the chest.
Wow. Wow. Did he ever tell you what it felt like?
I haven't really asked him. I think I don't really like talking about it around him.
Hey, you had your hand up. Do you want to share?
Remember, I know I got stuck outside a party.
Wow.
He died, didn't it?
How old was he?
18. He died on the same day his brother was born.
Thanks for sharing, guys. I've never worked with any young person who hasn't got idealistic goals or dreams or expectations. You know, they want the house, they want the car, they want the mortgage, but they are largely going about it the wrong way. And so a young kid who's 14, who's been involved in drugs, doesn't see that what he's doing is wrong. He knows it's against the law. He knows that the police are out there, but if you're coming from a background or you're coming from a perspective where I've got limited lifestyle choices anyway and I'll never get a job, I've got a criminal record, or who comes into the ends that really respects me, or, you know, then actually it pales in comparison to what you could gain by being a part of this group.
So within the context, or at least the context that they see themselves in, it's a rational choice.
Yes. And our job as practitioners is to show them that it's an irrational choice founded by rational means, and actually there are better ways. Yesterday I said to this young kid, you know, what's the positives of what you do? And he said, well, you know, I've got a company car, I've got a company telephone, I've got a company income. And I said, well, what's the negatives? And he's like, well, if my phone's ringing off the hook, Jay. Like, people are calling me up all the time. I have to be super intelligent, whoever I'm meeting. There's places I can't go. I might have to carry a knife in order to feel safe. If I'm selling and someone approaches me, I have to be aware that they could rob me. Yeah, so he's weighed up the pros and the cons already, but somehow, actually, the pros still come out on top. Like, some guys think, oh, cannabis is the way out, yeah? No, you're shaking your head. Like, so you know what I'm talking about. Like, reality is, you'll pay, like, £180 for an ounce and you'll get 26 bags of 10, yeah? How much profit is that? You guys do the math. £80, yeah? And out of that, you're selling 26 times. But the reality is, you have to sell 26, 48... 120 without being seen, without being stopped. If you get stopped, you lose everything. Everything. And if, let's be honest, none of you are going to be able to just roll out with an 800 bill straight. So actually, reality is you're probably ticking that stuff to start with. So you lose the drugs, actually, you've created a debt, which means free labour, which means that actually you're on the street now for free. You're not going to see paper at all. How many hours do you think you're going to be working on that street level for 24/7. The phone's going to be off the hook. Yeah? They were really, like, intelligent. That, but you could hear it. They were so intelligent and so clued up. But my gosh, I always get hit by their experiences. Like, most people knew. Like, everyone knew someone had been robbed. Like, two-thirds of the room knew someone had been stabbed. Stabbed. I need them to see and realise that there's opportunities for them and that they can achieve. Because if they just think like they've been written off, there's no second chance for them, then they're not even going to try, and they're intelligent.
What are the things that we would have to change
in
order for there not to be any crime?
Okay. We'd need changes in societal expectations, and we'd need a cultural shift. So one of the key areas, for example, is employment. Businesses could be incentivised to give ex-offenders employment, and it only needs to be simple things like reduction in tax or reduction in national insurance. I mean, at the moment, there's this whole furore about certain organisations not paying taxes, but actually, businesses could be incentivised, and it could be done off of a social impact bond way where it's payment by results.
Are some people just born bad? Are there some people who nothing is going to change them?
I came across many, many different type of guys in custody. I can't honestly, hand on my heart, say to you that anyone that I shared time with was born bad. Who's ready to write off an individual. Like, my gosh, if you made a mistake today, does that mean that you just written off? That would be astounding. Like, you'd be like, what's going on? We have to believe people can change, don't we? Because that's the whole point. And there's heinous acts that need to be punished, absolutely. But I do believe that everyone's got something to contribute.
The thing about talking to Junior is that his project is really just down the road from my house. So obviously the question there is, why them and not me? And that's not a frivolous question, because obviously I've had many more opportunities than most of those kids have had. But if we let go of the idea that we make choices and we should be answerable for those choices, then how are we going to change our narratives? How are we going to say, oh, well, I'm on this track, but I want to get off this track?
That completely resonates with me. I think we've still got this quite sterile category of criminal versus non-criminal, good versus bad, us versus them. And it ain't so. It ain't so. And then we've also got layered onto this delusion that there's a killer digital app that's going to solve crime and enable us to insulate ourselves from those wrongdoers. So if the future of crime and the committing of crime is going to be exponentially more digital, okay, so be it. I still think that the future of addressing crime is going to rest in the analogue.
So are you feeling more fearful or less fearful about the future of crime?
I'm feeling kind of mixed up about this. What I do think is this insight about narrative is kind of liberating. That we are locked into these patterns. We are all living out our Greek tragedies. We have elected these roles or found them thrust upon us. And if we were to find other ways to get those payoffs, yeah, you might move the needle on crime.
But if you're thinking of narrative as a way of foreseeing a pattern, isn't that just another kind of predicting? So what's wrong with the algorithm if what you want is the pattern?
We got the choice of the red boxes of the algorithm, where we are surveyed and I think something fundamental in our freedoms gets taken away. Then there's another option, which is we understand that we've already put ourselves in these boxes. We got the chance to reauthor the narrative and to achieve some sort of payoff by means that are not criminal. And that gives me some sort of hope.
So it's the difference between the algorithm writing the story in which we're the subject and us writing our own stories so we can change the ending. Join us next week to look at the future of energy.
Are we all going to have abundant, cheap power? And what does it mean if we do?
Future Proofing was presented by Timandra Harkness and Leo Johnson, and the producer was Jonathan Brunet. The programme was mixed by Gareth Jones.